I'm going to start out with a little autobiography. And what do I have, about 5, 10 minutes? What do you think?
10 minutes.
A little autobiography of how I got involved in the lead suits and also in the vinyl chloride suits, which led to my feeling personally oppressed, quite literally, by a number of actions that have happened. About 1985, a colleague of mine, Jerry Markowitz, and I began to a little project that we thought would last for about a year and a half, which was to write the history of environmental and occupational disease. We thought we'd write one book and get on to other things. We're now working in our 20th year and on our seventh book on the subject. And it's begun to drag. It dragged us into a number of lawsuits, and specifically lawsuits that involved research that we were finding. We came across about 10 years ago two sets of archives. One was an archive of the lead industry's documents through a law firm in New York City case, and then the vinyl chloride industry's documents that were stored in a little house located in Lake Charles, Louisiana, in the middle of a very down-and-out neighborhood, but a lawyer actually had over a couple of million pages of documents from the vinyl chloride industry. And because of that find and because of those two sets of documents, we ended up writing a book, the book that was just mentioned, Deceit and Denial, which is about the lead industry and the vinyl chloride industry, the plastics industry, over the course of the last century, and how lead and vinyl have basically kind of infiltrated virtually every aspect of our life in different ways. The first half of the book deals with the auto industry and lead paint poisoning, in which we discuss through these internal documents essentially what the lead industry did from literally 1904 on to basically deny responsibility for any damage done to children over the course of the century. And that included many actions, including the creation of the forerunner of Joe Camel, the Dutch boy painter who became a symbol of the safety of Dutch boy lead paint for thousands upon thousands of children and families and literally thousands of communities around the country, to the point where lead ended up on the wall. But the second thing they began to do was to develop a policy of trying to find ways of shaping knowledge about what was understood about lead and what lead represented, both for the general public through their advertising campaigns and also through their influence over the academic community and the shaping of understanding of lead and what its problems were in the academic community. I don't have much time to talk about that, but essentially it's from 1920s on, basically the sponsoring of research, the creation of actual institutes that defined what the problem was, close relations with government, and all the other kinds of things that we know happened in other industries, in the tobacco industry most famously, were in being shaped within the lead industry during this period of time. The way of shaping public understanding and professional understanding of what the problem of childhood lead poisoning was, and basically putting it both on the public and on the child and on the family, was really a policy that became part not only of public information, thinking that the child who had a terrible craving to gnaw things, for example, was the problem, not the fact that what he was gnawing was lead. The creation of institutes that said that families were responsible because they didn't watch children, or the whole creation of how we understood the scientific questions really became part and parcels of the industry's policies, literally from 1904, when the first studies identifying lead poisoning in children due to paint on the walls and on the fingers of children first appeared, straight through really the present, as these lawsuits now, after Rhode Island, continue in California, Illinois, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and other communities in Ohio and other states throughout the country, as these suits begin to become a major issue. The other part of the book dealt with the vinyl chloride industry and the creation of the plastics industry. And what it specifically did was discuss in minute detail through their own internal documents what happened when the plastics industry basically got bad news about their product, when they learned in the early 70s that their rat animal, their rats and their animals in their labs were actually dying from a strange, very obscure disease called angiosarcoma of the liver. And in this part of the book, what we look at is the way that the industry reacted to this knowledge. Basically, not basically, but in the most pointed ways, and the thing that caused the most problems for us personally, was how, when asked by NIOSH and OSHA and the other regulatory agencies, whether there was any problem with this new plastic called vinyl chloride, the stuff that we have all around us today, they basically feigned ignorance about their own internal knowledge of the animals that were dying and later some of the workers that were dying. So this became a very heated issue in a set of law cases, and we got dragged in both into the lead cases that are still ongoing, and which I feel really privileged to be part of in some sense, because it's very rare that a historian has any chance to ever have an influence over anything. So it's quite an honor that so much of the case rested on the historical evidence. I was personally on the stand for 6 days, and my colleague was on the stand for another 6 days in this suit, and it was quite a grueling experience and quite an experience in general for a mere historian. But what essentially happened to us very quickly was in some sense an example of what happens to others and others in both the sciences but also in the social sciences and the humanities when they begin to tell bad news about an industry. And in very short order, I'll just give you a 1 week in my life when I was sitting in my office going through my notes, writing some other stuff, and a phone call comes from a colleague who was one of the peer reviewers of our book. We had 8 peer reviewers of our book, of this book, published by the University of California Press. And he says to me, "David, I don't know what's going on, but I just got a subpoena to appear at a deposition. I've never been in a deposition. For an academic to be called to a court or to a subpoena is the most intimidating thing in the world." I mean, he was going to have a nervous breakdown on the phone. I had to calm him down. I said, "What is this about?" He said, "They want to know everything, want everything I've ever, any correspondence I've ever had with you, any emails I've ever had with you, any reviews or drafts of reviews. They want my entire computer file. They want anything having to do with my contact with you or the University of California Press or the Milbank Fund." I said, "Well, this is very odd. Don't worry," I said. And I started worrying. The next day, about four other people I knew, including the former head of the National Cancer Institute, who was also one of the peer reviewers of the book, the chairs of a department, distinguished professors at CUNY, other people began calling me saying that they had also been subpoenaed to go down to court to be to do something with the same kind of requirements. The day after that, I had I received a call from the University of California Press saying that they've got a subpoena and they have to turn over all their records relating to the publication, the peer review process, etc., of the book. This is very unusual for an academic book. Academics usually go through an incredibly rigorous review process, usually 2 people that review it who you sometimes know and sometimes don't through professional associations. And ultimately, the review process ends up in a book many years later that gets reviews many years after that, by the time you're about to retire. And, you know, so the idea that a book that just
a copy sells.
And about 14 people, including your parents, buy the copies of the book. you know, so this is very, you have to understand the culture of academics to know what this means. The university press gets this subpoena. Milbank Fund, who supported the publication of the book, gets the subpoena. And then, out of the blue, at the end of the week, comes a 41-page, single-spaced attack on us, a rather dramatic attack on us by a colleague, a fairly well-respected colleague at Rutgers University who has spent his time basically tearing into every aspect of our lives, accusing us of unethical conduct, of sloppy academic scholarship, of all sorts of professional, amazing attacks. Which, of course, for us was pretty amazing. We had to respond, and if anyone want to look at all of this, because one of the great things about working with students is that they're younger than you and they understand things that you just don't understand. And one of my students, as who was watching me sweat in my office trying to figure out what am I going to do, and you know how am I going to Xerox everything in my office, and how am I going to give my whole life to these guys, and what's going to happen to me if I don't? And he said, "You know what? And what's this attack mean?" He said, "You know what? you have all the documents that you quote, right? You have everything here. I said, yes. He said, why don't you write a response, he said, and we'll put it all up on the web. And it was like an amazing sense of freedom for me, because what happened was he basically knew how to do this. I had no idea how you put something on the web. And he did it all, and he put up a website that basically has all the review, academic reviews of our book, which were absolutely excellent, and the scholarly evaluations. And in addition, he put up the attack on us, and he put up our response and our footnotes and all of our documents online, so that people in the academic community who normally would not be able to figure out how to respond to this could actually look and see who's telling the truth about what we said. And what he put up on the line were the most damning documents, of course, where they signed secrecy agreements, the chemical industry. The people who were doing this were, by the way, Goodyear, Goodrich, DuPont, Monsanto, a whole bunch, the 20 biggest chemical companies in the world. So this was pretty intimidating when we realized this was going on. But the point I guess I'm going to make, because I'm going to shut up because I don't want to just tell my personal story, is that the history of intimidation of researchers and the shaping of researchers goes beyond just buying research. In some sense, it's not only the actual, in the lead industry, for example, sponsoring Harvard's lead research, which ends up becoming the basis for how we understand the dangers of lead for almost the next 80 years in the academic community. It's not just buying research that subtly gets shaped. It's also by, at times, I hate to say, actual intimidation. In our work, we uncover, and in the book, we talk about a number of situations in which researchers were actually threatened with suits, lawsuits, where researchers have been doing work on lead, stopped doing their work on lead for 10 years, get grants in order to do other work, and basically don't publish anymore. It's covering up research that is known, and it is a whole series of ways in which scientific integrity is really undermined by the entire process of the commercialization of science and the integration of science into much larger social debates about the impact of science and of materials on particular groups and the society as a whole. The end result is that we put up this website, and then I'll let Stan go. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. I was going to say 15 minutes each. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
You have like,
so,
you have like
3 minutes?
Dog minutes.
Four more minutes.
4 minutes. Historians, we work in 45-minute spans, so it's hard to cut down anything. I start talking, and I talk for 45 minutes, and I stop.
I never stop.
The latest thing that's happened, which I think is indicative of the kinds of ways in which understanding of science and the danger, the problems of industrial sponsorship of science is illustrated, is that after our attack, a number of reporters, and I really do have such admiration for some of you, were probably most important for our own sense of integrity, because we were pretty intimidated. And luckily, Lila Gutterman in the Chronicle of Higher Education and John Weiner in The Nation published two extraordinary pieces that for us, I think, were turning points in the way we were understood and seen by the academic community, because the academic community didn't know what to do with this whole issue at first. They didn't understand, they don't understand the legal system, and they don't understand what was at stake. And for them, it was just two historians kind of, battling it out in kind of a plague on both of your houses attitude. But when the articles appeared in the Chronicle of Higher Education and The Nation, and also in the Star Ledger in Newark, which was the home base for one of the critics, it was really a turning point for us, because they really did explain very clearly what was happening to us and really changed the mood. But we thought it was over at that point. But what's happened since, and these are two things that are kind of very important, is that after these poor souls were subpoenaed and deposed, their own testimony, such as, yes, we have great respect for Dr. Rosner, was used in a new version of this new attack as a sign that, therefore, they were not objective objective observers. One, the head of the National Cancer Institute was asked whether he checked every one of our footnotes, and he said no, because I respect their work and I know that they're honest. And this is before we put them up on the web so people could see that we were honest. No, because I expect, you know, that, but it made sense. It helped explain to me, he said, what had happened to me when, what happened when I was head of the National Cancer Institute during that moment and why this issue seemed to get buried. It helped explain a lot to me. It was then used as a sign that, he was not really seriously investigating. He did not seriously investigate the basis for our study, that he didn't check all of our footnotes. Another thing he said was that they asked him whether he was an expert in angiosarcoma of the liver, which is a disease that affects 12 people in the country every year, except if you work in the vinyl industry, where it actually may be a kind of mini epidemic. And he said, no, my expertise is X, Y, and Z, although I came across a lot of it because I was head of the NCI. They used that to show, they incorporated that by saying that he essentially was not an expert in his field, and that's the kind of peer review that this thing went through, that even, you know, that he wasn't an expert on angiosarcoma of the liver, and therefore his opinion was worthless about the value of our work. Other things like that kept getting incorporated. But the second thing that happened, and you should all be aware of, and that, you know, is ultimately, I think, probably the bigger influence, is that just now the Hagley Museum has removed all its records from the Society for Plastics Institutes, which is the trade association for the plastics industry.
You're supposed to give me an exclusive on that.
I'm sorry. Okay, I take it all back.
No.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. But the point is that this is, you know, this is probably, I'm not sure it's directly related to me, but certainly related to the fact that there's a growing awareness of the dangers of plastics in the community and the society, that there are a growing number of lawsuits, and essentially that the Hagley, which held itself up, even though it was sponsored in non-DuPont territory, DuPont's campus, as an objective scholarly repository, and has been fighting very hard over the last number of years to basically say that it is, and to maintain its academic reputation, is now being, in some sense, sullied by this whole debate, because one, the person who wrote the attack on us is the director of research over at Hagley, as well as at Rutgers, and he and also Hagley has now given back all its Plastics Institute documents, or is giving them back this week, I think.
Somebody should subpoena those so they can't shred them.
Well, that's what I'm worried about, is whether they're going to be shredded. I had a graduate student who went down and got as much as she could, but, you know, there are thousands upon thousands of pages, so we'll see what happens, but that's kind of the end result. So I apologize for not giving a kind of the academic overview of all the things that have been done in the past, but I think that they're not only past events, but they're also going on at the present. And we can talk about the specifics, I guess, maybe after Stan talks.
You went 1 minute over.
How do you like that?
Stan, you get
it's the
one
first
minute
time that's ever happened.
Thank God Stan's really like short and terse and doesn't like
to
talk.
Right. Well, that's a tough act to follow, of course. Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. Again, my name's Stan Glantz. I'm a professor of medicine at UCSF, and I have been involved one way or the other in the tobacco issue since 1978. I was one of the people who got the whole movement for smoke-free everywhere going. I've done a lot of the work on secondhand smoke, and that's really sort of how I made my name. And I've been attacked by the tobacco industry. It's sort of a cost of doing business. And in fact, journalists I know, they use the same strategies to go after journalists as they do scientists. People I know who are covering the tobacco issue early 90s, when there was a lot of interest in the US EPA's report on secondhand smoke that identified secondhand smoke as a Class A carcinogen. And I'm going to come back to that. But one of the reporters, in fact, a couple of different people said that they figured if you do one story on tobacco, it's like doing three stories, because then the CEO of Philip Morris writes a letter complaining to the head of AP or the publisher of the New York Times and making a bunch of these kind of wild-eyed accusations of the ilk you just heard, and then there's a lot of time writing memos and justifications. And so One of the ways these industries operate to intimidate people, in addition to the kind of bald-faced intimidations you just heard about, is to just raise the cost of doing business so that you are less productive. And, you know, professors get judged on how much they publish. You guys get judged on how many stories you get in the paper or on the air. And if they can make it harder to move the issue forward, then, you know, that's a discouragement. The reason I'm on this panel, though, I think, and I can tell lots of similar kind of stories. I think I have a thicker skin than you do, though.
You're older than me.
I'm older. Don't remind me. In May of 1994, I got a box with 4,000 pages of secret internal documents from the cigarette companies from Mr. Butts, the Doonesbury character, and we ended up putting them on the web and got sued over it and various other things. So, you know, just because people subpoena things, that doesn't mean you have to give it to them. You know?
Oh, no? I thought you did.
No. If I did, I would not even...
God, I didn't know that.
No. One thing I've been blessed with is the University of California has done a very good job of protecting me in the courts. And, we give them a very little of what they subpoena. I've got the same kind of subpoena, and I think in the end we gave them my resume or something. But people don't, and again, professors are not used to playing in this sandbox, and the first time I got subpoenaed, I was like totally hysterical too, but I called up, a guy named Chris Patty, who is the guy in the university's general counsel's office, who is my babysitter. And he said, that's ridiculous. You don't have to give them all that. And he fought them in court. It has to be relevant. I'll give you legal advice later.
Thank you.
And since then, we've put 50 million pages of the tobacco industry's internal documents on the web at the UCSF library, and if you want to go look at them, because they're there for everyone for free, the URL is legacy.library.ucsf.edu. And
excuse me, can I give the website for our?
Yes, absolutely.
www.deceitanddenial, all one word, .org. Not .com, because .com has been bought up by some Newt Gingrich's advisory firm. I don't know who it is, but...
But anyway, having been followed around by the tobacco companies all these years and having made a flip comment in Perth, Australia once at a meeting and then be beaten over the head with it 4 years later, where I said that one of the great things about secondhand smoke was it helped me pay my mortgage, which was a joke. It ended up in thank you for smoking, actually. But I decided I should start studying them. I mean, they've been studying me, so I started studying them. And the relevant part of what we did, which I'm going to talk about, I'm going to sort of do two things. I'm going to talk about what Paul asked me to talk about, and then I want to just offer a few other
things. Sorry. Thank you, Stan.
No, that's okay.
Thank you so much.
But no, about sort of how to deal with this stuff. There's this paper, it's in the back, it's called Constructing Sound Science, Good Epidemiology, Tobacco Lawyers and Public Relations Firms. And I just realized I actually handed out the page proofs. But the paper was actually published about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's the same. And, you know, you've all heard about junk science and sound science, right? It's been a very key element of the global warming debate. And, in fact, what this paper is about is how the tobacco companies invented the term junk science and the whole idea of sound science and good epidemiology. And it was done... because of this 1991 U.S. EPA report on secondhand smoke. In 1991, the U.S. EPA put a report out, which actually probably wouldn't have never been released except for Paul Rayburn's excellent science reporting, which kept the tobacco companies from burying the report. People at the EPA would call me at home at night, and then I would call Paul Rayburn. And everybody at the EPA never could figure out how he knew what was actually going on. But this report caused huge problems for the tobacco industry. It didn't really say anything new. In 1986, the Surgeon General had already said secondhand smoke caused lung cancer. But the EPA report did two things. One is to put a number to it, 3,000 lung cancer deaths, which is more lung cancer deaths than for all other forms of air pollution combined. And it listed it as a Class A carcinogen, which put it on a list with a whole lot of other unpleasant things like, I think, vinyl chloride and, what else? I can't remember what was on the list.
Benzene.
Benzene, formaldehyde were on the list at the time. But it really shifted the way people thought about secondhand smoke away from being a health issue to an environmental issue. And the public has completely different attitudes about health risks and environmental risks. It's why somebody who doesn't wear a seatbelt gets all hysterical if one flake of asbestos falls out of the ceiling. I mean, it's the difference between perceived voluntarily assumed risks and involuntarily assumed risks. And the publication of the EPA report triggered a substantial increase in the rate at which local communities passed laws restricting smoking. And these laws are a tremendously good thing. They substantially reduce people's toxic chemical exposure. They improve the quality of life. We've now shown they actually reduce heart attacks. But they also make it easier for people to quit smoking and cost the tobacco companies a ton of money. We've estimated that when you make a workplace smoke-free, you get about a 30% drop in cigarette consumption. And they also prevent kids from starting, and they undermine the overall social acceptability of smoking, which is just the core way cigarette companies sell cigarettes. So they really felt the need to do something about this. And so in order to try to undermine the US EPA, Philip Morris came up with the idea of attacking the scientific basis of the work. And they created something. They hired a big public relations firm called APCO Associates, which works for a lot of big industries.
Which, by the way, I want to say something. We get every year journalists that are affiliated with SEJ. We get a letter from APCO asking for you to respond to a poll, and they will donate $20 to a nonprofit of your choice. Don't do it.
Yes, they
and
like
use those polling numbers to figure out what you're thinking and how journalists think, so that they can shape their messages.
Right.
When they send out PR to journalists. Easy.
Yes, they're pretty bad, and they also are the people who organized the whole tort reform movement for the tobacco industry, and also their youth smoking prevention programs, which don't prevent youth from smoking. So they're pretty bad guys. APCO was actually created originally by Arnold and Porter, which is a law firm that represents the tobacco companies, and then they spun them off later. Anyway, they created something called the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition, run by a guy named Steve Malloy, who came up with the term. You've all heard of Steve Malloy as a source. And what they realized was that if they were out there as the sponsors, that nobody would pay any attention to it because it would, you know, be the tobacco companies and nobody trusted them. And so they went out and they recruited the pharmaceutical companies, the chemical companies, the oil companies, a lot of other big businesses which were concerned about science-based regulation affecting their bottom lines. The tobacco companies footed the bill for the whole thing. It was organized by APCO and the tobacco companies' lawyers. And then what happened over time is a lot of these other interests realized this was actually a pretty good idea, and it's taken and been spread. And I think so the whole idea of creating false controversy about science, which is something really the tobacco company started doing back in the 50s with active smoking, was sort of taken to a new level. And they go to great lengths to hide their involvement. They work through lawyers, they work through public relations firms, they set up foundations and launder the money through those things. And we know all about this from the documents. And A lot of these people, and Paul could probably speak to this better than I could, but a lot of these people just show up over and over and over again. So whenever you have a source that you're going to, which is coming up with a kind of contrarian view of global warming or toxic chemicals or anything you happen to want to think about, mold, I would strongly urge you going to the legacy site and just seeing if they're in there, because there's a very good chance they are, because these guys are sort of multi-purpose naysayers, a lot of them. And like I just found out that James Enstrom, who is a researcher, he's not a regular faculty member, but a researcher at UCLA, who did a big study for Philip Morris saying secondhand smoke didn't cause cancer and heart disease, just recently did one for the Electric Power Research Institute saying particulate air pollution isn't the problem. I also do a lot of work on air pollution with the Air Resources Board, and it is a problem. Particulate air pollution causes heart attacks, among other things. What the tobacco companies did, and at the session this morning, I was the guy they wouldn't let ask the question, and so I'm going to make the comment I was going to make there. The fact is that there is no perfect study. You know, if you give me any piece of research done by anybody, including me, Bob, anybody, I'll find something wrong with it. Okay? Because there is no one ever does a perfect study. And what the kind of people that the tobacco companies and other companies following on them, and they kind of took what the lead industry did and took it to the next level, is they're what I call dissemblers. And what they'll do, you know, because generally the way you guys cover things is you need a hook. And the hook is some new study, right? You know, you're looking for news. And so there's a natural tendency, and it's reasonably legitimate, to focus on what's new in the new study. And so the naysayers, and I'm not saying every study is perfect, it's not, you know, will come in and find some little thing to pick at and criticize in that study, okay? And at the same time, the tobacco companies and the global warming naysayers and various the other kind of things you said are funding other people to produce negative studies, which are usually, as Paul said, they don't falsify the data. It's through cleverly framing the question or spinning the results by leaving some, not emphasizing things or emphasizing the wrong things or changing the language, and I can give you lots of examples of that. And so they try to create a controversy around some little nuance in the piece of work, and at the same time, the negative studies, you know, have huge public relations machines, megaphones behind them, blowing them up all over the world. And for example, this paper by Enstrom, which he managed through a massive failure of the peer review system to get into the British Medical Journal, which is a highly regarded journal. And I was a journal editor for 10 years. And peer review is great, but it isn't perfect. That study is just dead meat. Nobody who knows anything about secondhand smoke pays any attention to it. So from the point of view of the internal workings of the scientific community, it wasn't a problem. The self-correcting nature of science that everybody loves to talk about, I think, has already worked pretty well on this paper that this guy published. But to the public, to public policymakers, it's out there. It's being brought. I just got an email from somebody that came up in South Africa last week. And you've got these huge PR machines out there taking this stuff and flogging it. And flogging it to people who often don't really even understand vaguely how science works. I mean, you guys are a very sophisticated audience. I'm used to dealing with, I love it when I get to talk to people like you. Usually it's like a general assignment reporter who calls up with like the wire copy and said, could you tell me what questions I'm supposed to be asking? And they're very good at manipulating those things. And I think that the thing, that the way I decide if a case is made, the way I decide if A causes B, because as people say, correlation is not causality, is I think you have to step back and look at the larger body of evidence and try to ask yourself, does the whole story fit together in a rational way? And if it does, then the fact that every study can be criticized is not so important.
Two minutes, Dan.
Okay, I'm just about done. And for example, and I'm trying to give you some practical advice on how to deal with these things. You know, if you do a test tube experiment or a molecular biology study, you can really control everything very tightly. It's very clean. You can say that in this very artificial environment, A caused B. The problem is life is not that artificial environment. At the other extreme, you have big population-based studies, epidemiology and medicine, or the, you know, kind of big global climate studies when you're talking about climate change. And those have the advantage of being in the real world, but they're always messy. And the more real they are, the messier they are from a kind of reductionist scientist perspective. And so what I try to look at is, do all the pieces in between fit together? And if there's a consistent story, then, you know, I say A causes B. And so my advice to people, and it's a way to deal with the junk science crowd, is to really, after you talk about the specific new study, to really try to put it into context of the larger literature and the larger body of knowledge, and ask, how does this advance our understanding of things? And given whatever the criticisms are, you know, how important are those in terms of the bottom line? And if you do that, I think then the kind of games and tricks that the junk science people play won't work. And I'd just like to close by coming around back to that and picking up on a point David made, where he talked about how the lead industry tried to shape the very way scientists think and this is like a very kind of mega thing, but that's exactly the kind of thing that tobacco companies have tried to do too. And I remember years ago getting a call from a friend of mine, he was a professor back east, and saying, I just got a survey, kind of like the APCO survey, asking me if I thought risks below 2, which means exposure to something doubles the risk, is real, could be real. You know, and you'll hear when you talk to epidemiologists sometimes, well, a risk below 2, that means you're exposed, you're twice as likely to have the disease as if you're unexposed. Isn't really real. Well, the origin of that was this Sound Science project. And what they did was they went out and tried to make the argument that any risk below 2 isn't worth thinking about. Why? Because all the risks associated with secondhand smoke are below 2. And so they were trying to just define the problem away. And I think this problem is getting worse over time, because industry is becoming much more sophisticated about how they do these things. They've learned a lot from the tobacco companies. And the other problem is, as funding for universities and for scientific research is now growing, it's still growing, but it's growing much less slowly than it did over the last 10 or 15 years. State funding of state universities, I'm one of them, is not grown. And so the administrations in these institutions are getting increasingly desperate for money and really putting pressure on faculty to get money, because there was this gigantic expansion in the last 10 years based on all this easy-flowing government money, which isn't flowing so easily now. And so there's I think, getting to be an even greater reluctance to do or say anything out of the university administrations to piss off industry. And so I think at the same time, you're going to see more and more faculty, especially junior faculty, who are under pressure to get that corporate money and therefore not piss people off. And my last little tale. And
then you have one last
minute. Okay, I have one last minute, but he went over. This is the last of the last. I just want to give you an example of one of the things David said, where they try to induce people to kind of go off in the other direction. One of the things I've been working on over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years has been the issue of smoking in the movies. Smoking in the movies gets kids to smoke. When you put smoking in a youth-rated film, it's like putting lead in the film, as far as I'm concerned. You're poisoning kids. It's a great story that there hasn't been a good science story written on yet, by the way, so I will chill for that. But there was a very important study in Germany that was reported first about 3 months ago that replicated an American study that showed the more smoking in movies kids see, the more they smoke. And the fact that this is replicated or done again in Germany, where it's a totally different social environment, the smoking rates are much higher among kids, there's cigarette vending machines literally on every corner, it's the one developed country where the tobacco companies are still viewed as legitimate, and got almost identically the same results as was found in America. Very important scientific finding. He worked with a friend of mine at Dartmouth on it, and saw this guy at a meeting a couple weeks ago, and he said about a week after they reported the German results, a representative of the German tobacco companies went to his colleague in Germany, who he'd done the study with, and said they would generously fund him to do anything he wanted except that. Okay? And no, this happens. And it's like, you know, no strings attached, total freedom. You can study anything you want as long as you don't study this stuff which is doing damage to us. And, you know, that's one of the ways these guys work. So I'll shut up now.
I want to add two quick things to each one of these. It was interesting when Stan started talking about Steve Malloy and the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition. I just found a document just last week. I was looking for some stuff, and I found a document. It's from a PR company in 96. It was a report they were sending one of the tobacco companies, and down like on page 3 it said, work with Steve Malloy to on future developments for the Junk Science website and shaping comments. Also put Steve Malloy in contact with Tony Snow, who's writing a op-ed on regulations. Some of you might know who Tony Snow is right now. So Malloy has
another one is Todd. What's Tozzi? Jim Tozzi.
Jim Tozzi, yeah.
He's another one of them.
So I think, one of the last thing I thought was interesting, which you didn't hit on, I thought was interesting about when in your book where the lead companies tried to say that the reason why there was such high lead levels in black boys is because their mothers were not controlling them. These kids were out of control. They tried to put it in that issue. They tried to shape it like the racial issues.
Oh, that's absolutely, that's still going on. I was in a case in Mississippi, which was something out of the 1920s Scopes trial, where these kids were held up as basically not worthy of ever being considered for the fact that they had lost, on average, 15 points of IQ, because after all, they would never amount to much anyway. And the racism of the lead industry in this trial was quite amazing. They actually had a black lawyer present this chart that looked like an evolutionary chart, a descent chart, in which they had mugshots of each one of the kids and every relative that ever had not graduated from high school on this chart, and anybody who dropped out of school from third grade, and all in a descent tree indicating, and they had a black psychologist present this as a sign that these kids had not lost IQ because of the lead that they had eaten, the fact that they had 60 micrograms per deciliter lead in their blood. But it was because 10 is like, they're now trying to drop it down to 5.
There really is no safe level.
There's no safe level. Yeah, every time you get a new measure, a new way of measuring lead in the blood, you know, the CDC tries to get it to drop. Ironically, the CDC, during the Bush administration, its panel on lead has been totally recomposed. The leading lead researchers have been kicked off. They have one guy named Banner from Oklahoma who claims that unless you have 80 milligrams or above in your blood, which is industrial lead poisoning from the 1920s, right? That's when kids are go into comas. You're not truly lead poisoned, who are now on that panel. It is really a terrifying thing that's happened. But the short point I wanted to make is that the whole science has been just collapsed into a huge, you know, in the absence of a regulatory state, in the absence of regulators who are willing to do something, it's become a public relations issue, and the issue of race is still as potent today as it was in 1920. 20s, at least in Mississippi in this trial. It was truly horrendous.
Okay, we're going to take questions now because we don't have much time. And I saw Joe, your hand's up.
I guess this would be for either of you or both. David, one of the points of attack on your work was the peer review process. And I think the timing was actually pretty close to the Office of Management and Budget's peer review bulletin. It was a White House policy that essentially tried to set White House set standards for scientific peer review in government agencies.
It was David Paul, yeah.
Well, that was one of the claimed legislative bases for it.
Oh, you're talking about that.
But they put out a separate bulletin directing all federal agencies to come up with peer review policies. Many of them had highly evolved peer review policies already. Anyway, I wonder if either of you would care to comment on that, and does it have anything to do with science fiddling?
Well, certainly since Daubert in the early 1990s, the Daubert decision in which the issue of junk science came to the fore, and the peer review process in academics has been severely under attack. And peer review has always been a problematic. It's the only way that academics really have of judging each other and trying to give some kind of quality control on what's published. A lot gets published that's junk. I mean, not junk in the junk science sense of the term, but is not very interesting, pretty boring, and pretty well known. And beginning in the 1990s, there's been an attack on the ability of scholars to really judge what is accurate science or what is good science. And in the case that I was involved in, and in this situation, it's taking it a step further. It's taking it out of the courts, and it's actually trying to attack the peer review process in the halls of academia in and of itself. Our book was reviewed by 8 reviewers, which, if anybody knows the peer review process, is off the charts. I mean, just off the chart in terms of the number of people that reviewed it. They were all brought together to review the book in California. They were all flown in to review the book in a group after writing their reviews to discuss with us problems that we should correct before we published the book. So it was very thoroughly, from an academic standpoint, it was extremely thoroughly reviewed. But from the perspective of the industry, this is all used as an indication that, one, we had actually met our peer reviewers, all 8 of them, and two, that they weren't really, it wasn't a blind review. So all sorts of questions about peer review are being brought to the fore, and because there's so much scientific uncertainty, and this is really a product of the last 30 years. I mean, it used to be that when a doctor said something or a scientist said something, we all believed it. And in medicine, when the germ theory was understood as causing disease, epidemiology itself had a kind of nice, neat little paradigm where you could identify something, and if you could show the tuberculosis germ was there and you had tuberculosis, you assumed it had something to do with the germ. But you environmentalists have really screwed things up because now there, I say that laughingly and lovingly, because in the last...
For the record, that was a joke.
That's a joke for that lawyer in the back who's... I used to introduce the lawyers because I used to recognize them, and I used to say, would you please stand up and introduce yourself to the group, national-led, please. But I don't recognize you here today. None of you are here today. It just distracted me completely.
It's all part of the aging process.
Yeah, it's all part of the aging process. But in short, I'm going to stop here, but the peer review process itself has been really under attack. And because environmentalism has really raised all sorts of questions about multiple causation and the fact that there are many causes of many different conditions, and it's almost, and there's so much medical uncertainty about so many causes, that an industry can point to any one of a number of possible pollutants to essentially blame conditions on and blame symptoms on, and hence deflect attention. And epidemiology itself is really going through a kind of crisis, I think, because all the tools of epidemiology were built around the germ theory of disease, and now we have multi-causational models that are so complex and that we can't ever really say in epidemiology anymore what causes what. Epidemiologists are always saying there's an association between, but we've avoided the word cause, which in the world of the law, has become a wonderful whipping boy for essentially saying, we don't really know what really causes anything, do we, Professor X, Y, or Z? Even in tobacco, you could say that with asbestos and other things, right? Tobacco is one exception.
I actually think you're going off the deep end a little bit here.
Thanks.
First of all, just so you know, the Data Quality Act was the Philip Morris's idea. That's something in the documents. And I can't remember if it was Malloy or Tozzi.
It was Tozzi.
They hired get the Data Quality Act through. And the basic reason they did it was because they wanted to get more access to raw data so they could give it to their statisticians to spin the way they wanted to. That was really one reason. And we know all this from the documents. The second reason was to just simply slow the process down and to make it ever harder for government to issue regulations on anything and to create a whole new set of legal grounds for challenging regulatory action. And so that's where the Data Quality Act came from. You know, peer review, and again, I've been a peer reviewer. I was an associate editor of a big cardiology journal for 10 years. You know, it's a good system. I mean, it's where you take things people have written, you send it out to people you think are knowledgeable, and you look at what they say, and then you make a judgment on it as an editor or as a publisher. And, you know, you try to get good people to do it. You hope they'll pay attention. Usually they do, but people make mistakes. The one thing the peer review process is not good at is detecting fraud or spinning or leaving things out, because the reviewers are given what they're given, and the presumption, there's always a presumption that you're dealing with an honorable person when you're a reviewer. And, you know, that's just sort of, you know, the way it is. And I think that what the industry has taken to doing, and the tobacco companies have done, and Paul was talking about another example, you know, when the peer review system started filtering out the trash they were trying to get into the literature, they just created a journal of their own, you know, and then get the stuff published in there and then put it into their PR machine. So, you know, you really need, you know, you're out there dealing with people who are just really trying to confuse matters. The fact of malt, I agree with what David said about epidemiology. It's sort of based on this one thing causes one disease model, which isn't true. But my big beef with epidemiologists, and some people think I are one some of the time, is that they have this very limited view of reality, which is all based on statistics. And I mean, I've written a couple books on statistics, so I know about statistics. It's wonderful. But, you know, this gets back to the point of considering the full body of evidence all at once. And epidemiology is a very useful tool for observing associations in the real world. That's all it ever is. You can't go out and do an experiment where you say, we're going to have this group of kids eat lead paint and that group won't, and follow them up and see how what it does to their IQ. That's how you can make a causal statement. You can't do that. All you can do is observe what happens. But you can combine that with animal studies and things like that, which aren't people, and where there's all kinds of problems with them. But when you put the two together, then you can start saying something. And my big beef, I'm having a big fight with the chief epidemiologist at the Cancer Society about whether passive smoking causes breast cancer or not. The California Environmental Protection Agency says it has. The Cancer Society refuses to accept it. Another good uncovered story, and which I'm shilling. And it's all because when I go to Michael Toon, who's their chief epidemiologist, and say, what about the 20 mammary carcinogens in cigarette smoke and the genetic damage which is detected in human breast tissue in people exposed to these things? He says, I'm not a toxicologist, you know, which to me is a complete cop-out. And I say to him, and this is the question I think you guys should always ask, is stepping back and looking at the body of evidence, the whole body of evidence, is there a credible alternative hypothesis that explains the data as well? And I've never been able to get Michael to answer that. And I think when you press these sound science people, that's the question to ask them, in addition to really pressing them about where's their money coming from. Because as David said, and is in the handout, there's a very well-developed literature now that shows that when people get corporate funding, it tends to bias the results.
So I'm going to move on. Okay. So I'm just talking about that. There have been numerous studies now that have come out, mostly published in the medical literature, where you can take, let's say, 150 studies on, like, there's one in the back on bisphenol A. It's a endocrine disruptor that's found in plastics. And you can look to see, I think we have, 130 studies. All the studies that found an effect between bisphenol A and endocrine disrupting activities were funded by the government, and all of those funded by industry found no effect. So that's sort of what we're talking about on conflicts of interest. And in many journals, we'll actually disclose in the study, if you get the study, where the funding came from. However, what's happening right now is this is big in the medical journals, but it's not that common in the environmental journals. And just to let you know, I did a study where I looked at Pat Michaels, one of the climate skeptics, and I called up the editors of the journals where he had published in American Geophysical Union, American Meteorological Society, and Pat Michaels had not listed his funding coming from all these industry sources. And when I asked the editors of the journals, do you think you should start to disclose this? Do you think you should have disclosure policies? They were said that they were uncertain if they should or they should not. And this is dramatically different from the way it is in the medical field, where it's understood that you have to list where your money's coming from. And so the next question is Charlie.
I have a question about selling something. Before I became a journalist, let me just preface this to say I work for a consulting company, a very high-level consulting company, and we were working at the time for the defense of General Electric on the Housatonic River. And I'll never forget being in a conference room having meetings with their project manager. And this is years ago, so I feel like I can say this now. And the conversation degenerated into this guy basically shrieking at us. I was there with my bosses, who were all PhDs from Duke, from Harvard, and the big places. Get those numbers down. The whole point being that we had to modify our exposure such that we could bring the permissible exposure at some of the between contrast with what the EPA was doing. So in that sense, what I was always left with from that was that this is not science, because to me science starts with a hypothesis and then you test it and you see what happens. In this case, the objective had already been defined, so it reversed the whole process.
So you're talking about the risk assessment.
Yeah,
right?
I'm talking about risk assessment in this case, but I'm also questioning the premise of sound science. To me, always seems to have an industry objective in mind. And so it goes in reverse. Instead of doing the hypothesis and testing it moving forward to see what happens, the objective is defined and you have to do what it takes to get to that objective in the first place.
Right.
So my question is that science? Can we even call sound science science?
Well, first of all, the whole idea of sound science is just bullshit. I mean, I've been in meetings and I've said to scientific meetings, how many people are in favor of unsound science? You know, how many people are in favor of junk? Nobody is, you know? I mean, it's a rhetorical device that has been created to attack legitimate work, you know? Now, the in terms of the thing that you're talking about, what the game that people can play is they can construct a study in a way to kind of get the result they want, you know? And that is, you know, if you look at the Enstrom study on passive smoking, what he did is he used an old data set the American Cancer Society had collected called CPS-1, which was collected in the 50s and the 60s, and he compared exposure to lung cancer and heart disease in I think it was just women, I can't remember. No, I think it was both women and men, married to people who smoked compared to people who didn't smoke. Now, the first study of lung cancer and passive smoking was done in Japan. It was published in 81, so it was done in the 70s. Marriage to a smoker was a great surrogate measure for whether you were exposed to secondhand smoke, because women didn't smoke and women didn't work outside the home. So basically the only exposure they were getting was their husbands and their smoking friends. Okay, well, in the 50s and early 60s in the United States, a lot of women were smoking, a lot of women were working outside the home, and so you were comparing non-smokers married to smokers who were breathing massive amounts of secondhand smoke to non-smokers married to smokers who were breathing massive amounts of secondhand smoke. And of course you were going to get a negative result because you were comparing it exposed to exposed. And the Cancer Society told him not to use the data set. There's a newer data set where they had better exposure measures, which is the one he chose not to use. Well, Philip Morris funded him to study the CPS1 data set. And the result, I could have told you the result without doing the study. So that's one of the games. Now, in his defense, Enstrom, who I'm sure will buy the tape, you know, he will argue vociferously that I'm wrong, that the Cancer Society's wrong, that what he did was reasonable. He's like the only person who thinks that.
And then, okay, we're going to move on to the next question. Yes, Sarah.
Yeah, I would just like to have a discussion or quickly answer this or apology to other people. As a journalist, as a working journalist, what are the ways that we can tease out these funding patterns? You know, there's not like a database like there is for, you know, campaign financing or something that I'm aware of. So how do you research these funding issues if it's not already disclosed when the journal article comes out? And it's not a known person.
Well, I think you could ask them.
Yeah, that's one.
Now, you know, now they might lie, or you know, you could ask them, and if it's some odd-sounding foundation, you might check out where they're getting funded.
There's also a website called SourceWatch, which follows a lot of these guys. And also another thing that I've done is, whenever I run across any of these people, I just go to the Tobacco Legacy documents, I type their last names in, and I do a search to see what they were doing, just to give me a sense of. Because almost inevitably, if they're a toxicologist who's working for a chemical company or whatever, they tend to be doing the same thing with tobacco back 10 years ago. And just to let you know, one of the guys working with Steve Malloy right now is a guy named Tom Borelli, who was at R.J. Reynolds or
Philip Morris. It was Borelli who actually invented sound science.
And Borelli right now is doing climate change for the National Center on Public Policy Research, which is the think tank, whatever it is, that felon lobbyist Jack Abramoff used to funnel all the Indian tribe money through to his own think tank called the Capital Athletic Foundation. So these guys tend to, like, they figure out a pattern, you know, just like you doing a story. You know, I start off with a, you know, sort of a little, you know, brief idea, then a nut graph, then I'm, you know, they have this figured out too, just like you do as a journalist on how to write a story. They have this pattern figured out. And so they tend to, once they kind of go over towards the industry, they tend to stay there.
I was just going to say, it's really insidious. Even in on my tiny little world of the history of medicine, which is basically, you know, 12 people around the country talking to each other once a year, it turned out that the president of our association had been working for the cigarette industry for literally 14 years, giving depositions and testimony,
undisclosed.
And that caused a little crisis, but then it turned out that the people in our little group that were working for the lead industry and writing books and articles saying lead was not a problem historically were also working for the tobacco industry as well and had been doing that for the last 14 years. So it's really infiltrating into not only the hard sciences, but also the kind of academic disciplines, the obscure academic disciplines that are really, in some sense, shaping the academic view, the scholarly, removed, most esoteric views of these substances. And that's the really terrifying thing.
Yeah, and the tobacco companies have had a program in the social sciences to do this too, which I'm blanking on the name of right now. But one other plea I would give you is that, you know, writing a fair story, and this was a point one of the speakers made this morning, doesn't always require that you present, quote, both sides.
A balance.
I think that there are lots of legitimate controversies out there, and I'm not saying you should become propagandists, but, you know, when you sit back and look at the balance of information in front of you, if the critics sound stupid, there's no reason to give them a platform, because to the reader and to the listener, it sounds like it's a 50-50 split. And I'll just tell one quick story. When we published our first really big paper saying passive smoking caused heart disease, I got a call. It was from King Radio in Seattle, wanting me to do a debate on our paper. And I said, I will be happy to debate any competent person who's read it who isn't paid by the cigarette companies. And they said, well, we have a debate format. I said, fine, I'll debate anybody who isn't paid by cigarette companies. They can think I'm completely nuts, but they've got to, A, have read what we did, and B, not be paid by cigarette companies. And they could not find anybody. And they found a couple people, and I said, oh, I know him, David Weeks, I don't know if you've read any of him, and a couple others. And in the end, they said they could not find someone. Every cardiologist they had read the paper agreed with it. And I said, that's my point. You know, and I think that is, and I'm not saying everything we've ever done is perfect, but, you know, I think those are things you need to really consider when you're deciding how to present criticism.
So we're out of time right now, and I want to thank everyone so much. If you're interested, Stan commented that these two guys are really good sources of information.
Yeah,
thank
we
you so
can
much.
Hang around for a few minutes.
Stan's going to continue to talk.
So they call him Darth. Darth, he's already. I mean,
you should force him out. The sooner the better. I don't know. I don't know the politics.
Any dirty politics? I don't know.
He is.
This is not to sell tickets.